David McCullough, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author who has lovingly crafted narratives on subjects ranging from the Brooklyn Bridge to Presidents John Adams and Harry Truman, made him among the most popular and influential historians of his time, has died. He was 89. McCullough died Sunday in his Hingham, Massachusetts home. He had been in failing health and died less than 2 months after his beloved wife, Rosalie. McCullough dedicated himself to sharing his own passion for history with the general public. He saw himself as an everyman blessed with lifelong curiosity and the chance to take on the subjects he cared about most. His fascination with architecture and construction inspired his early works on the Panama Canal and the Brooklyn Bridge, while his admiration for leaders whom he believed were good men drew him to John Adams and Harry Truman. In the 70s and 80s, he indulged his affection for Paris with the 2011 release of The Greater Journey, and for aviation with the bestseller on the Wright brothers that came out in 2015. David McCullough was a frequent guest on this program, as well as the book show.
I spoke with him in 2017 about a project he worked on examining the American spirit through speeches he'd written and delivered throughout his illustrious career. I asked him what made him want to revisit and compile that work.
It began with the oncoming of the election, but also with the way things were going in Congress and the lack of any willingness to work together to solve the problems that we face. I've long felt that one of the most important lessons, if you will, of history is that nothing of consequence is ever accomplished alone. It's a joint effort. And if the members of our legislative body won't come together to help resolve some of these critical and very serious issues, then we're in real trouble. And of course, with the passage of the year, 2016, the viciousness and defaming and indecency of so much of what was said grew only worse. And I was trying to think, what could I do to help, maybe, if not stem the tide, at least make it have an effect on those of us who still feel the way we do about our country, that there are some forms of behavior that are not tolerable, and that there are realities to the present day that we have to address, or we're in deep trouble, and we have to do it together.
I want to talk about that togetherness and some of the problems we have to tackle. You have a figure where you say some 80% of colleges and universities no longer require history for graduation.
That's correct. It's not quite as high as 80. It's almost 80%. And it's a real shame. It's part of the decline of the humanities. That's a very bad way to go. We're so tied up with this notion that information is everything that we forget that information isn't learning. And if I like to tell students that if information were learning, if you memorize the World Almanac, you'd be educated. If you memorize the World Almanac, you wouldn't be educated. You'd be weird. And and so far, no computer has ever had an idea. So to use the mind, to use the reach of the mind, to use the reach of the imaginative, creative strengths of the human condition in art and music and literature and medicine and everything else. You have to read. You have to be educated. You have to know history. History is the greatest source of learning there is. There's no subject from which you can learn more than history, because history is about who we are and why we are the way we are. It's human. It's so often made boring by, unfortunately, we've all had them, boring teachers or boring writers,
right,
who stress statistics and dates and memorizing quotations and so forth. When in the course of human events is how our Declaration of Independence begins, and the operative word there is human. That's what history is. It's human. It's a story, multifaceted story, to say the least.
It is very much about cause and effect. And how do you make that more palatable, do you think? I mean, you certainly have through your career and in your writing and had people reading books that they probably never thought they would read otherwise.
Well, one of my professional heroes and somebody I really admired tremendously, both as a human being and as a historian, was Barbara Tuchman. And she said that in one of her speeches, or maybe it was one of her essays, that there was no trick to getting people interested in history. She said, I can answer that in two words, tell stories. That's right. That's how I feel, and that's what I've worked very hard to achieve in my own efforts.
This book is a collection of speeches that you have given at universities, that you have given across the country, even before a joint session of Congress, the White House. And when you started to look at them, what did you want them all to focus on? What was key for you in looking at your past work of things that you have said in the past that you wanted to put together in this American spirit?
Courage is one, and the courage of our convictions. And obviously, truth and tolerance as essential to our way of life. And loyalty and hard work. We Americans have always been hard workers. There have been exceptions, of course. And we like to accomplish something of worthiness. And the happiest people that I've come to know in writing our story as a country have been those people who've had purpose in their life, worthy purpose. My book on the Wright brothers, for example, brought that home to me in a way very little else that I've ever known equaled. That's the way they were raised at home. How we're raised at home is far more important than I think a lot of us are willing to keep in mind. Yes, school, college, all that, very, very important. But those basic values we learn at home about being kind to one another, about not smearing or inflicting fear on someone because they don't agree with you. You don't do that. And you're a good neighbor. You're a good friend. You're loyal. And you really believe in equality. And you understand perfectly that we're all immigrants, except for Native Americans. We've all come from somewhere else. And that's part of our creed. It's part of our faith and the system we've established. We're the only country that has an exact time of when it began. We know when we began, why we began, what struggle it was. And we mustn't forget how much sacrifice and how much uncertainty those before us faced in order to achieve what has been nothing but benefit to us. Be as if we were spoiled brats who had no notion of how it was we got to live in such a fine house or have such nice clothes or go to such good schools or all of that. It's a form of gratitude as well as education.
You point out that the best of our presidents, and using the presidency as a model of leadership, were all avid readers of history, with many of them being historians themselves, Woodrow Wilson, Theodore Roosevelt,
exactly right.
John Kennedy, Dwight Eisenhower. How do we benefit from that in those cases, and what do we lose in our current case, where I believe it is safe to say we have a president who does not have a regard and does not read historical
things? That's right, and boasts about it, that he doesn't need to read about those things because of the reach of his mind is such that it's not necessary for him. Well, that's absolutely absurd. It would be as if you put somebody in the pilot's seat who'd never flown an airplane. He might be handsome, he might be tall, and he might have a glowing uniform or whatever, but he doesn't know how to fly the plane. He doesn't know where he's headed, and he doesn't know the rules by which one conducts oneself in that responsibility. History is about cause and effect. Every action has a consequence. Inaction can have a consequence. And you have to understand that. You have to understand that presidents are often served their best by what they decide not to do. The fact that Eisenhower, for example, decided not to go into Vietnam, or that John Adams decided he would not go to war with France at a time when there was no possible way that we could have defeated the French, and when most of our country wanted to go to war. These decisions are often overlooked because people just don't notice it. I think one of my favorite, well, two comments on that, on the importance of history that I'm very fond of. One is Harry Truman said that the only new thing in the world is the history you don't know.
Mm.
It's all happened before in one form or another. And if you don't know that, then it's all new to you. And the other one was when General Marshall, George Marshall, was appointed Secretary of State. He was asked at a press conference, early press conference, if he'd had a good education at the Virginia Military Institute. He said, no, I didn't. And they said, why not, sir? He said, because we had no history. History is a lesson in how the game is played or how the game is lost or how the mountain is climbed or the bridge built or the cause of the disease discovered. And history, very importantly, history isn't just about politics and the military. It's, of course, much of it very concerned with politics and the military. But there's an enormous amount of it and should be taught as an enormous amount of part of it. It has to do with music and art and architecture and discovery of ideas and ideas that can change the world and have again and again. We live right now, for example, in a time when when life on Earth has been dramatically changed just in our lifetime by medicine. But we just sort of take it for granted. This is all just happening around. Oh, yes, yeah, now they can do this or they can do that, and they know how to cure this, cure that. This is of immense historic importance and should be a great source of the pride that we should have in our schools, our medical schools, our laboratories, our ability to use the mind for the benefit of mankind.
I was greatly moved during the 2016 election, about midway through, when you and Ken Burns and several other prominent and very respected historians came out and expressed your concern over the candidacy of Donald Trump. One of the things that I thought was so interesting about it was it was not political, it was right and wrong, and what we can learn from history. And I'm interested in, because I would just think, given the neutrality that historians generally have, that A, must have been a very difficult decision to make, and B, that you make that case and yet it doesn't resonate with the lion's share of the American people.
Oh, yes, it does. Let's not forget that the popular vote in the election went to Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
By almost 3 million people.
Right.
So, yes, there was a far greater turnout of approval for Donald Trump, but it was not an overriding landslide by any means. And we still don't know what may have been going on behind the scenes that we need to know about.
Right.
But in any event, it wasn't an easy decision for me, I know, to come out, because I think most of us who write history feel that we have a professional guideline, a professional rule of not being ardently left, right, whatever. But this was more than we could stand by and watch and keep our mouths shut. And what was so gratifying, Ken Burns and I first talked about doing it, and we were ready to do it if it was just the two of us, but we had no trouble rounding up people. I've forgotten how many finally said something. I think it was over 50. And it reached a very large audience, and thankfully it did. And it's still going on and should go on. There's nothing wrong with professing what you believe in our country. Let us hope it will always be that way. What is wrong is to attack someone because they differ with you. Attack them in a mean-spirited or cruel or unkind way to defame them in an attempt. One of my favorite moments in all of history, one of my heroes was Margaret Chase Smith. And I have the scene in the first chapter of her first speech in my collection, where she stood up and faced the oncoming, really evil, of Joe McCarthy. How brave she was to do that, to have done that. If I may, I'd just like to read the line. She said, "I speak as a Republican. I speak as a woman. I speak as a United States Senator. I speak as an American. I don't want to see the Republican Party ride to political victory on the four horsemen of calumny, fear, ignorance, bigotry, and smear." That's exactly what Mr. Trump was dishing out by the shovelful through that campaign. And it was disgraceful. And I felt no longer tolerable for anyone, historian or not, with a conscience, who's part of one of our role as Americans is to speak up, express what we feel. I'm an optimist. I am, and I know how much we have to correct and change for the better. I know how much is done that is disgraceful. I know that there's ignorance, and there's greed, and there's selfishness and materialism run rampant in much of our society. But I have traveled all over the land for more than 50 years, lecturing, speaking, teaching. I've been in all 50 states. I still at it. And I have always come back with a sense of fulfillment that we are a good country. We are a good people. And we 90% of us are a good people. And I say so in one of my talks. We go to work and try to do the best we can. We look after our families. We save money and work harder to provide education for our children and grandchildren. And we should take more heart from that. The problem is it's the loud, blabbermouth, insulting clown who can get all the attention. It's always been so. And it's nothing new about it. We've had this before. We've had outrageous behavior on the floor of our Congress, with people going at each other with fire tongs. One Southern senator tried to murder one of the outspoken opponents of slavery on the floor of the Senate. And we've had corruption before in politics. But if you keep the faith and keep your confidence and stay by the standards that the country was founded on, all the evidence from past experience is that we will come through. We will overcome. We will fix the problems.
You quoted Harry Truman a few moments ago and talking about history and that it does repeat itself. But really, have we seen anything like this, where especially for a relatively young country of what we have done in a very short period of time?
No, we've never seen anything quite like this, because we didn't have the carnival quality that television can bring to our political world. And we've had carnival con men and snake oil salesmen all through our story, all through history, well before anybody ever set foot here from Europe on this continent. But the cumulative effect of outrageously big money and television and these other means of communication like Twitter and Facebook and so forth, that's changed things rapidly, right? And obviously, and that's new. Truman again once said, you have to wait 50 years for the dust to settle. And I think that's more true now even than before. In other words, we won't really know what it all looks like until it's over. But again, I feel very confident that the plummeting popularity of our present chief executive is not just a temporary thing, and it's an indication of the judgment of the fairness of our country and its people.
One of the speeches that's included in your book is Which Way Forward, and it was a speech that you gave in 1994 at a local college to us, Union College in Schenectady, New York. I'm hoping you can read, assuming you have a book in front of you, I'm hoping on page 41, the third paragraph that begins with "Let's do something." I'm hoping you could read that paragraph because I'm fascinated that this was written in 1994 and yet how it applies and what wonderful language
it
is.
That speech, I have to tell you, I'm very proud of that speech. I was very surprised when I was invited to come to Union College to read about it, to read its story, to know its history. And to me, it's an emblematic accomplishment in our country. When you think how early it was done and how many pioneering attitudes they were fostering. But I thank you for asking me to read this. Let's do something about public education. Let's stop the mindless destruction of historic America. Let's clean up our rivers and skies. And while we're at it, let's clean up our language, private and public and on the airwaves. Let's stop dumbing and degrading and cheap commercial exploitation of American life. That's exactly the way I feel still, and even more so than when I said that in 1994.
Well, certainly. I mean, it feels like it is a direct plea for.
Yes, I could have written it this morning with the same fervor.
Well, I am pleased that you, as you say, you're an optimist, that there is optimism.
Yes, I think history generates optimism. It helps to diminish the hubris of the present. The present is just terrific in every way, and nobody's ever been like we are, and nobody's been so nifty and attractive and cool and all the other things. No. I remember standing in front of the Birth of Venus in Uffizi Gallery in Florence, Italy once, and just being breathless at that such a masterpiece, such a magnificent work of art could have been produced so far back and by another human being. Phenomenal, thrilling. And I feel that way about much that we take for granted every day.
I know in previous conversations with you that of course historians deal with the past and not the now, and that it's for the future to decide what our history tells us. But it seems hard to believe that in 50 or 100 years we're not going to look at this period in time and say, what the hell happened?
I think you're exactly right. What the hell happened? We've made big mistakes along the way, and we've made one. Last November, huge mistake, one of the most serious mistakes, in my view, in the history of our country. But we're good people, and we'll right the ship.
How do you, because obviously that devolves very quickly into a political right versus left, but I'm interested.
No, it's not right versus left.
Well, and that's exactly
it's
what
right
I want to get to.
Wrong.
And that's exactly it. Of how do we as American people and concerned citizens make that argument more clearly that it isn't about politics, that it is about right and wrong?
By sitting down and talking reasonably, with respect with those who disagree with us and working it out that way. And by standing up and expressing what we feel. This march about science, the Women's March, I thought the Women's March was one of the most hopeful things that's happened in a long, long time.
Mm.
We're not just going to say, oh, so be it, and go about whatever else we want to do. We have, among the problems we have, like money and politics and others, is the danger of becoming a nation of spectators. That we just sit and watch the show or the sports event or whatever it is, or the television that night. I love to see people getting out and doing things, accomplishing things together. And to say, no, there's some things we will not tolerate. There's some things we do not accept. Some things that we want to have accomplished that must not be ignored any longer. And I have great faith in this young generation coming on. I really do. I think they have deficiencies in their education, particularly in history. But I also know that I have a large family. I have 19 grandchildren. Mm. And I see what these young people have on their minds and what they want to see happen and what improvements they would want to see take place in our way of life. And I'm very hopeful because of them. And I'm very hopeful because of our teachers. Our teachers vary in their ability, and they vary in their focus and their gift for the magic of teaching. Of course they do. But they are doing the most important work of any of us because they are shaping this oncoming generation. And in many ways, they're doing a marvelous job.
Author and historian David McCullough speaking with us in 2017. McCullough passed away on Sunday at the age of 89. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.